First of all, welcome. And on behalf of the volunteer network that for nearly 20 years has comprised SLOT, I want to thank you all for making the time to join this conversation, for sharing your work, and contributing to this small but really vibrant series of intimate workshops. As the global community struggles to navigate today the intersecting pandemics of climate change, racism, COVID-19, and so much more, the centrality of health and social justice to life itself is indisputable, even as it remains ever so elusive. This pivotal moment demands that we re-examine how we integrate and how we align our individual and our organizational practices with a broader vision for a more equitable and ecological world. But it also asks that we revisit and rethink the very way in which the arts contribute to these urgent and oftentimes intersecting conversations. In the curatorial language for this gathering that I imagine you've already kind of had time to spend, you've already spent time with, we invoke the celebrated French theorist Félix Guattari's manifesto, The Three Ecologies from 1989, where he expands the definition of ecology to encompass human subjectivities and social relations interconnected with their surrounding environments. At SLOT, we have a similar vision of interconnectedness. We've always sought to foster learning and collaboration across the arts and culture sectors, but also across health and ecology and social justice as well. And we envision the arts as a sort of bridge between disciplines, institutions, and geographies. Most of all, we believe that the arts afford us like a unique threshold through which we can understand, but also ultimately challenge the impact that social systems have on individuals, communities, and the broader environment. So following Guattari's lead, recognizing the need in these times of ecological crisis for a new philosophy with arts and culture at its center, we decided to call this event the Ecosophical Imperative. I wanna take a moment to first of all, thank the primary organizers of this conversation, including Stephen Duval, Billy Fleming, Sarah Lewison, and Marina McDougall, but also the collaborators who are sharing their work today, Richard Walker and David Goldberg. I also wanna thank Amy Franceschini and Sol Martinez Perez and Susan Schwarzenberg, who are joining us for our future conversations in the series and some of whom are joining today's as well. So our partner, as you know, for today's conversation is the Ian McGarrig Center for Urbanism and Ecology at the University of Pennsylvania, where SLOT is also situated. The center has spawned a nationwide call, a super studio, to landscape architects and so many other practitioners to develop ideas that complement the Green New Deal. It's our goal with this gathering and subsequent gatherings to make a bold case for why the arts should also be imperative to any Green New Deal vision. And so through a discussion of historical, contemporary, and speculative models, we're hoping to consider how an ecosophical imperative offers the potential for a new awakening through arts and through culture. So at this point, I want to turn it over to Marina McDougall to offer a few framing thoughts. But again, thank you all so much for sharing your time and your work and your thought with us.
Thank you, Aaron. We're grateful to be able to present this series of workshops through SLOT with its almost 20 years of dynamic and critical dialogues. In this afternoon's conversation, Roots, Arts and the New Deal in the 1930s, we will begin with a lay of the land from Billy Fleming, director of the Ian McHarg Center at UPenn. For the last several years, Billy and his collaborators have been doing an incredible job orchestrating a national conversation on landscape design and the Green New Deal. I find it rather incredible to consider that over this past academic year, students around the country have been imagining what form a Green New Deal might take in their regions and communities. We also are joined by Dick Walker, who directs the Living New Deal Project and is a brilliant mind on political ecology. For more than a decade, Dick and his collaborators have been documenting the vast legacy of the New Deal, and now we are suddenly poised to reimagine and implement them for our time. David Goldberg, a creative and critical thinker, will bring focus to Gordon Parks, an artist whose career was launched through the New Deal as a photographer for the Farm Security Administration. As we begin this conversation, we ask, what national challenges did the original New Deal set out to address? How was it effective? How do our current national crises resemble the Great Depression? Why is a Green New Deal important? Why was art included in the programs of the New Deal? How did arts programs of the New Deal manifest? How was it orchestrated? And what aspects of this legacy are valuable for our own times? Those are a lot of difficult questions to answer in a few short minutes, but now we'll turn it over to you, Billy.
Great. Well, thank you so much again for the invitation to join you all for this series and for that lovely introduction. I'm going to just kind of launch into this because I feel like the easiest way for me to get into some of the work to frame up conversations about the Green New Deal and some of the ways we've tried to approach it is just to do it. And so for me, it's always important to begin with the kind of the literal text of what we mean when we say Green New Deal, and to pull here from House Resolution 109, the non-binding resolution that introduces it to the public in its sort of current form a little over 2 years ago, almost 2.5 years ago now. And it was just actually reintroduced on Earth Day this past April, which calls for many things. There's only 14 pages. It calls for, you know, in its own words, a kind of generational, multi-decadal policymaking agenda, and calls for many things that have really nothing to do with the built environment or with space, but also calls for many things that do, some of which are listed here, right? So I won't read all of them. This is an exhaustive list, but retrofitting every existing building in the country for maximum water and energy efficiency, remediating every single hazmat and brownfield site in the US, overhauling the US transportation system, all of these things kind of bundled together represent a kind of generational project. And I think it should be clearer now, if it wasn't already, that Green New Dealers have always thought pretty explicitly about their program as a crisis-driven program, a sort of stimulus measure meant to fill the kind of void that COVID-19 has created in our lives and our economy and all kinds of other places. Whether or not they're actually successful in this sort of first test is still to be determined. And I always feel, at least for me, because of where I sit, that I think a university that thinks of itself as quite progressive, but is actually quite conservative, to answer the question, like, why focus on the Green New Deal? Why not other climate plans? And the other is the obvious answer to that is that it's just wholly unique amongst American climate plans. It's the only one that's been put on the table that even attempts to fuse the more technocratic demands for decarbonization with similar demands for blue collar jobs, good paying union, dignified jobs, with similar demands to center the investment side of the program in frontline and fence line communities. So if we think about the three pillars of the GND as this jobs, justice, and decarbonization agenda, we can imagine it kind of becoming its own crisis-driven stimulus package, linked to the slide I just showed you. And for us, for me in the center, the last few years have been about this trying to link that set of radical demands, mostly from the climate justice movement, which are often abstract, often aspatial, non-spatial, with demands from friendly legislators who we get the luxury of being able to work with, who are hungry for more opportunities to channel those demands into what they would call marker bills or active legislation meant to shift frames of conversation, not necessarily to be signed into law, but often lack the in-house capacity to do so. And as a result, the McHarg Center has been kind of a first money into something called the Climate and Community Project, which is this a really phenomenal interdisciplinary network of climate and built environment scholars, many of them folks who do ethnographic or fieldwork-based work, bring their own relationships with movements and elected officials and others to the table for us, and include folks you probably know, like Thierry Francos, Daniel O'Donnell-Cohen, Lefemi Taiwo, Raj Patel, and many others who you may or may not know who are kind of listed here. And their work, you know, the work we've been able to do together has been hugely rewarding for us personally, but it's also, I think, helped to begin adding some sort of meat to the bones of the Green New Deal. So thinking about going beyond HR 109 into what became the Green New Deal for American Public Housing Act, introduced in 2019, just reintroduced a couple of weeks ago by Congressman Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Sanders. We were, you know, really the leading researchers behind what would become that bill. A similar sort of effort is underway now around public education with Congressman Bowman. And we just, you know, this is an image from a report released a couple of weeks ago tied to the use of NYPA or the New York Power Authority to implement their state level Green New Deal laws, the CLCPA. And of course, to do this work, I've thought a lot about the work that Dick and his colleagues have produced at the Living New Deal, one of the most important resources for the work that I've been doing here over the last few years. and have thought about it. The Living New Deal itself really, I think, helped me find my feet in this conversation around the Green New Deal, thinking about it not as, say, the progenitor of Social Security, although it certainly was that, but more as sort of the instrument through which the built and natural environment of the US was transformed through the construction of, say, 55,000, 60,000 relatively quotidian projects all around the country. We think of the more heroic ones like the TVA, the Grand Coulee Dam, and others that are obviously important, but it was the sanitary sewer systems, the civic infrastructure, the libraries, the schools, the housing that it made possible, that I think the Green New Deal kind of once again is putting on the table for us to think about. Because ultimately, for us in the center, the work has been organized around this theory of change that no one will understand or should be expected to understand the Green New Deal through, you know, the density of molecules and carbon molecules in the atmosphere, or the source of the electrons in their circuits, but rather it's through those investments in how and where we live, in our homes, where we work, how we get between them, if we have kids, where we send them to school, if we get out of our house and want to go play outside, where and how that happens. Those are the things that offer a real opportunity to show the public luxury that a program like the Green New Deal has to offer. And, you know, for the last couple of years, I've led a series of interdisciplinary studios here tied to some of these questions, and really beginning in the first iteration of it with this, with some questions put to students about where to prioritize, knowing that the Green New Deal itself is always going to be something we recognize in the aggregate. There wasn't a piece of legislation passed by FDR that was the New Deal. It was, you know, 5, 6, 7 years of consistent both legislative and executive policymaking. So ask students to think about what are the first places to send that first wave of investment. And of course, they could have answered that question in many different ways. And ultimately, I think settled on three pretty wise regions: Appalachia, the lower Mississippi Delta, and the Corn Belt of the Midwest. You could include many others in that, but it pretty obviously, I think the way I asked to think about it excludes places like the Financial District of Lower Manhattan, maybe Hyde Park in Chicago, some of the other places with real nexuses of wealth and technical and political capacity. And then ask them to think about, you know, again, to pull from the work that Dick and others have done, trying to contextualize the New Deal, to think about the built environment legacies that it left to us, many of which we are still living with. So on the left here, you see the physical footprint of the Rural Electrification Administration spends about $180 billion in adjusted dollars over the course of the New Deal to build out 380,000 miles of rural electric transmission line, which is about 42% of the lines ever built in the history of this country. And then on the right, you see the work built by the Civil Aeronautics Authority, the predecessor to the FAA. They spend about $1 trillion in adjusted funds over the course of the New Deal. And among many other things, built up our municipal airport infrastructure system, including LaGuardia, Midway in Chicago, and many others. And then ask students to move away from this idea of problem solving and instead to focus on creating an exhibition of ideas for their kind of first studio review. So here, looking at the kind of GND's core tenets implemented across a particular range of Appalachia, ask them to sort of stretch themselves and think about what a propaganda campaign might look like in support of some of that work. And then had a few students do what they always do in studio, which is their own thing, and had it work out wonderfully, in which they produced a series of kind of graphic novels and zines tracking people sort of pre and post Green New Deal throughout the Midwest. And I think Marina is actually in one of these shots somewhere, was kind enough to come to their exhibition a couple of years ago and led to the super studio that she mentioned, which is this really fantastic effort we thought would maybe get 15 or 20 schools across the country to treat the Green New Deal as kind of their brief for the semester or for the year. It wound up getting about 220 and about that many as well in independent practitioners and firms. For us this past year, that meant sticking with going back to those same three regions in the studio, Appalachia, the Midwest, and the Lower Mississippi Delta, and focusing in on three particular industries: industrial agriculture, the fossil fuel system, and the carceral system. Lots of reasons for that. We could talk about that as much as anyone would like to. But the most, I think, important one for this conversation is just that those are the three industries identified by the merger of what's called the Green New Deal Network, the sort of national organizing table for Green New Dealers, with the Movement for Black Lives last summer in the aftermath of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor's murders. And so there, you've probably seen the last couple of weeks something called the Red, Black, and Green New Deal. It's a program that Colette Pichon Battle at the Gulf Coast Center for Law and Policy has been working on for the better part of a year. We were lucky to be in on some of those early conversations, and so tuned the studio to those particular issues or questions. And in Appalachia, had a group of students focus in on this prison building atop abandoned mine lands industry, which is, you can see here, some of these prisons built atop abandoned mines. That became a core part of their sort of studio focus in the second version of this studio. Looking at the reasons why this happens, there's a massive incentive structure. There are state and federal grant programs to support specifically the construction of prisons atop abandoned mines there. The second is that the sites are already cleared and actually quite easy to build on top of. You can build literally almost anything you want. And the third is that you actually do not have to remediate these sites to the degree what for almost any other land use if you want to put incarcerated people on top of them. And so working with Colette and others, that group of students sort of went through, you know, what would be the sort of steps 1 through 50 on the march to prison abolition through the principles of the Green New Deal. And for them, that meant developing this basically guidebook for how to decommission a prison and convert it into a rural electric co-op. One of the weird quirks of the prison facilities of Appalachia is that they all have to have the ability to island themselves off from the grid. So they have the ability to basically keep their operations going in a regional blackout. They're also on mostly flat sites. So they're actually the best parts of Appalachia to build renewable energy generation and storage on. And their existing power supply today to power a town of 2,000 people or so in Appalachia. So that was one piece of it. I won't spend a ton of time on the rest of these. I had some students work through this process of trying to think through ways that you might democratize the design process. I had a group of students, one of whom was a dual MFA, MLA student, working with Chickasaw and prison abolitionist leaders throughout the Mississippi Delta, developing these portraits of the future, merging oral histories and kind of climate fiction together. In these lovely images you see here, they became sort of zines or comic strips tracking some of these folks through the implementation of the Green New Deal in each region, and actually wound up being voiced by some of the folks in the region that we work with in the studio. All of this stuff kind of lives, if anyone just like isn't getting enough screen time, on the website they built as a part of this studio. But I will end it there. I would normally play this, but it's a few minutes, so I'm not going to do that. This is a podcast they developed as well for the studio. But with that, I will stop talking and turn it back to you, Marina, to keep us going.
Thanks so much, Billy. It's amazing. I have a million questions, but I think we should move on to Dick and just keep our conversation going here.
All right. Well, that was impressive. Hard act to follow. That's just great. By the way, Billy, that was really wonderful. I'll correct you on a couple of things. There have to be at least 100,000 New Deal public works out there, and it's probably twice that. And I usually say a New Deal went 10 years, 33 to 42. So now I wasn't crystal clear what we wanted to do here today, because I figured I'd be talking to the converted, and I didn't know if you really would want a history of the New Deal. So I'll show you what I did, which was a little little mock-up about thinking about art in the Green New Deal, and I'm going to share my screen here. Thinking I did not want to do a whole talk on the New Deal. Okay, what could I do? Well, about art, I'm not going to give you a lecture about what the New Deal art programs were. There are people much better than I to do that. But I have learned a hell of a lot about what the New Deal did in general, overall, and what lessons we can draw from that. Though one of the lessons is we don't even know what the New Deal did in terms of public art. We hear a lot that there were 40,000 artists hired, but there's no documentation of all the artwork. Nobody's ever documented even post office murals, let alone everything else in civic buildings, outside civic buildings, bas-reliefs, and so on. So it was absolutely massive. And of course, it's an inspiration for today. So I won't get into the fact we're interested now in art preservation, because New Deal art, nobody is systematically working to preserve it. And a lot of it is neglected, being sold off, privatizations, and also under attack for imagery that's now regarded as inappropriate, but often isn't, but because New Deal artists were smarter than that. But anyway, they had every kind of art program, and from the visual arts to music to writing to, of course, architecture, which was not a separate program, but part of everything they did in terms of public work. So I thought I'd throw that in there. Park design, civic building design, bridge design, and so on, which are arts in the largest sense. And of course, what exactly is art is we won't even try to grapple with that. But obviously, if we're talking about a New Deal, Green New Deal art, we got to talk about all kinds of new things. You know, you might talk about video games as an art form, all kinds of commercial graphic art. So we don't usually think of is the classic New Deal murals, but they did a lot of graphic art in their, you know, propaganda art and so on. So, but I think you'll see that I'm going to end up kind of biased toward some simple visual art and propaganda. It got me thinking about, okay, what did the New Deal do? What were some of the key functions in the New Deal? But first I thought, okay, what are the functions of art? What can art be used for? What can it be used for a Green New Deal? What was it used for the New Deal? And obviously this is a long discussion, but I just knocked off a few items here about everything. I mean, it isn't just to beautify, but it is. It was to educate, uplift. The New Dealers had a very broad sense of sort of the public good and how art fit into that. Everything from simply keeping artists alive to improving the lives of everyday Americans who, for instance, had never heard symphonic concerts or maybe had never seen a serious piece of live theater. And the effort was to get this out to people, of course, in the biggest cities, but out very far and away. And beyond art, of course, just to get culture, like, you know, the Kentucky book women who horseback book riders who would take books from the library up to people isolated in the mountains. So it's pretty much everything. And they were very sort of unchained artists. There was not a lot of strictures on it. There was not a lot of guidelines given to what it could be. Some cases, like with post offices or federal buildings, you had to go through a civics arts commission or something like that. It was a commission. And in other cases with relief art, where they were hiring unemployed artists to keep them alive and put them on a certain project, they had a lot of freedom of what they were going to do. So that's what the New Deal let artists exercise their craft within pretty broad outlines. And that's, I think, the most desirable scenario. But the artists themselves, what did they do with that? Well, some of them did what they felt like. Some of them did abstract art. There was abstract art in New Deal building, New Deal murals and so on. Others taught, others used money to teach with. They would do local history. So a lot of, say, post office murals are local histories for good and bad, because a lot of the local history, even if you're honest about it, wasn't something we would celebrate today. You know, a lot of them were critical of the mythologies of American history. Of course, they worked within the styles of the day. And then they also did things like they were trying to get new music, compose new music, perform the music project, federal music project. All these were, most of the ones we know about were under Art One, which was under the WPA, but there were others under the Treasury Department, the CWA earlier, the sort of predecessor of the WPA. And they were, you know, would exercise the popular styles, but also the kind of popular ideology of the time. And a lot of New Deal artists, because they were hired by the New Deal, because they loved the fact that the government was supporting New Deal art, because they were part of the time, were very much promoting themes of kind of American renewal, American rejuvenation. But they were not asked to celebrate the New Deal. They were not asked to do political art or anything like that. So you have to give people a lot of license. So I like to say they just shared the enthusiasm. So I thought about six themes that I would use to illustrate kind of New Deal themes that might be useful to the Green New Deal today. I love this poster. That's about as political as art at the time, but this was not, I don't believe this was not paid for by the New Deal. One of my first theme is, of course, with climate change today, it was conservation then. What we don't realize, I think what most contemporary Americans, environmentalists included, don't realize is how ravaged the American continent had been for two centuries before the New Deal. It started to be addressed with the Forest Acts of the late 19th century. And of course, conservation movement had started up around the turn of the 20th century, but it hadn't gotten that far. And the New Deal did a lot to address the problem of the lack of public land, the destruction of agricultural land, the Dust Bowl, of course, that's pretty famous, the cutover forests, the great American forests of the northern tier had been completely slaughtered for the previous century of industrial timbering and so on. So there was a lot of it was about restoration of the American land, but it was also at that time, recreation was a huge theme, trying to get people out of the cities, out of unhealthy environments of the cities, out of their working jobs, long work hours, get kids recreation. So healing the land, restoring people through recreation were huge themes. And the joy of interacting with nature, I think, is one. These are very sort of simple, old-fashioned themes, but ones that would be very valuable for the Green New Deal in terms of the kind of arts, what artists might be imagining. It isn't just about political propaganda about politics, which is fine. I love propaganda, but also about those kind of pretty simple themes because they really connect with the public, which is important for today. They also did a lot of documentation. Second theme would be sort of we're all in this together. And of course, the Green New Deal emphasizes social justice as it absolutely should, inequality. And the New Deal also addressed inequality by trying to raise, mostly thought of as economic inequality, class inequality in a kind of economistic way, because that's the way liberals thought at the time, and even a lot of radicals. It was pretty rare to talk about racial justice, though the New Deal did do some of that, and we could go into that more if you want later. But the theme of we're all in this together really worked as a way of mobilizing people and getting the feel that this was for everybody, for all common Americans. That's really an important theme of kind of of a simpatico president for all his other failings of Roosevelt. And same with Joe Biden, have that sense of connection with the common people. I did want to put this, you know, we always see these CCC posters that are very white, but in fact, there's a lot of New Deal artwork. This is actually in a high school in Pasadena. It's about CCC workers, but it clearly shows integrated CCC camps, which there were in California at the beginning of the New Deal, before the white CCC enrollees and the local people and the hierarchy up in Washington ended it. A third theme that I think is important is about mobilization of the people and a sense of participation that is very important. And I think, you know, Billy's work with the students illustrates this, you know, this works at all levels, from common laborers to sophisticated engineers and architects and designers, is getting Americans to feel they're participating in solving the problem. And the New Deal was very successful at that. It wasn't just relief and investment, and we're gonna hire some workers to do this, and we're gonna build some bridges. It was actually mobilizing people and aiding them at the same time and helping working people feel that they were rebuilding the country along with FDR. And so this was really a theme, of course, of the arts of the time. Social realism, American scene painting could include these themes in a very obvious way. So some of the art styles of the time were very useful precisely because they emphasized some of the themes that the New Deal itself was emphasizing. And maybe we need to bring back the old WPA sawhorses or something like that wherever Green New Deal projects might be done, or New Deal or Biden, whatever you want to call them, projects are done. A fourth theme would be about modernity. We often, people don't understand how much the New Deal was about modernizing the country. Billy touched on that with the electrification, which was to bring the 20th century to everybody. Electrification, paved roads were probably the most obvious. Trucking, for better or worse, the automobile, for better or worse, that's what they were doing. They were bringing what was defined as the most modern infrastructure, most modern technologies that everybody should have to every corner of the country. And that's what the Green New Deal means too. It's going to mean a lot of technical innovation, a lot of general upgrade of infrastructure. And I think we forget the popularity of those themes of modernity in the mid 20th century. We're all very cool postmodern people now. We've learned to hate modernity and themes of the modern. But in fact, an important asset of the New Deal was that love of the art of that time for machine age kind of themes. Also, you can see, I mean, here's a train, a typical Art Deco poster of that time. But on the right, there's this, this mural from the Department of Interior in front of the Bureau of Reclamation Office about dam building. You know, dams were seen as these marvelous kind of modern structures. They were beautifully, you know, Hoover Dam is an Art Deco dam, really Boulder Dam. I hate the fact they called it Hoover Dam. And this is by a guy named, I'm going to forget his name now. It's in the Department of Interior. And these, you know, it's social realism. It's that sort of, in this case, white masculine labor, which we would critique today, but at that time did show this sort of participation of people, the exaltation of the modern. And by the way, he worked, this is a little hammer and sickle because he was a commie. So he snuck that into his art. The New Deal artists were no fools. A fifth theme, am I going too long, Marina?
Maybe just one more minute?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm pretty much done. What we also forget about is geography in the sense of spatiality, that the New Deal worked everywhere. It got into every corner of the country. And this is a theme we have to remember. There are some people within the Green New Deal movement who clearly understand rural areas, agriculture, small town, forgotten, declining economies, and so on. The Green New Deal has to do that. But we also have to remember scale. The United States is so huge and it's so regionalized, and I'm happy to see Billy was talking about regions with the student projects. And the local, the New Deal was actually brilliant at working with the local. That was sometimes a deficit, but often it got the buy-in, the participation of local governments, local people. What did you want to do? Okay, the WPA will come in, hire your people, hire your local architects, and build that school or build that road work or redo that park or whatever it might be. And the Green New Deal, there's so many opportunities for small scale projects of this kind, serving local desires with local people that is manifest. And we have to remember this. If you want to be politically successful, this stuff has to show up in people's lives. And it has to show up in ways way beyond just checks in their bank accounts. And the final theme is, I think we should never forget that Americans love themselves and they love their individuality and the whole theme of freedom that's been stolen by the right. So while we on the left tend to emphasize collectivities and the social needs, which is correct. At the same time, you can emphasize individualism and unleashing your freedom through these federal projects, through large-scale programs, through a sense of participation in a national renewal program that you are going to be in, and that you also can add your creative labor and creative ideas to, but also through art, simply unleashing that kind of personal creativity. Art programs have to be more than professional art. They have to be education, bringing art to the people, letting the people participate in the art and unleash their own creativity. And on that note, I'm done.
Excellent, Dick. Thank you so much. And everybody should really take time to look at the Living New Deal website, which has is a vast resource of amazing materials. Amy Franceschini has joined us from Ghent. It's a dark there. Welcome. Next, we're going to go to David Goldberg.
Hi, folks. let's see. I'm going to share screen. And I'm going to be talking to you guys today about Gordon Parks, who is an amazing character. And I'm just going to jump into it. So we're going to be looking at reflections and projections of Gordon Parks. Oops. So he was not only a photographer, which we know him as, but he was also a poet, a composer, a film director, and a co-founder of Essence Magazine. And he was actually invited to participate as a fellow for the Farm Security Admin because he had already won some recognition for his photography, photographing everyday urban life in Chicago. He was self-taught, but his participation in the FSA really transformed his whole perspective. And what I'm going to talk to you guys about today is the sort of long-term impact that his participation in this New Deal program, what the impact was on American culture in general, starting with photography, but it eventually turned into film and went on to influence a ton of other cultural formations. And when I think about how a Green New Deal might work in investing in the arts, it's to think about that as well, that it's a long-term investment, like not just in terms of representing the actual activities that are going on in terms of, you know, community justice and restoration and things like that, but the fact that it unleashed the creativity of these artists to actually create industries that that only now we can sort of look back and recognize as being this output. So when I think about the long-term impacts of the New Deal, it's not just about, you know, the technological infrastructure and the paving of roads, but as we'll see, it's about massive amounts of cultural formation that we don't really recognize as having been seeded by this effort. That you can see in the slide, and he was the first Black man to write, direct, and score a major Hollywood movie, which happened to be autobiographical, The Learning Tree, the first to work for Life magazine, and his photojournalism made fundamental contributions to Black visual culture. And he gives tremendous props to this man, Roy Stryker, who you see on the left. And I'm gonna read this quote from him because when he went to DC, when Parks did, he was told, Stryker took his gear away and said, I want you to go out and hang out in DC and take a look and then get back to me. And that was when Parks encountered the degree of segregation that was going on and came back completely outraged. And according to his autobiography, Choice of Weapons, Stryker told him, you can't take a picture of a white salesman, waiter, or ticket seller and just say they're prejudiced. That isn't enough. You got to verbalize the experience first, then find logical ways to express it in pictures. Think in terms of images and words. They can be mighty powerful when they're when they're fitted together properly. And the image on the right is a very famous image of Ella Watson, who worked in the building. And Stryker actually told him, like, yeah, that's a great photograph, but you need to get to know this woman. So Parks did. And I'm going to read a little bit from, this is a very amazing section of his autobiography that really lays out how heavily influenced he was. For several weeks, I went through hundreds of photographs by Dorothea Lange, Russell Lee, Jack Delano, Carl Mydens, John Vahon, Arthur Rothstein, Ben Sean, Walker Evans, John Collier, and others. the disaster of the 30s was at my fingertips, the gutted cotton fields, the eroded farmland, the crumbling South, the unending lines of dispossessed migrants, the pitiful shacks, the shameful city ghettos, the bread lines and bonus marchers, the gaunt faces of men and women and children caught up in the tragedy, the horrifying spectacles of sky blackened with locusts and swirling dust and towns flooded with muddy rivers. There were some, no doubt, who laid these tragedies to God, but research accompanying these stark photographs accused man himself, especially the lords of the land. In their greed and passion for wealth, they had gutted the earth. And I want to pause here for a moment, because as I was reading, you know, this paragraph of his autobiography, I was really blown away by exactly how specifically what he's describing addresses what we're dealing with today. And I love the fact that, you know, we just heard about the being reminded of how devastated the environment was in the 30s, and we're facing that similar situation again. So even at this moment, Parks is sort of reminding us that this is a really amazing time to start thinking about art and visualization. And I want to point out, like, it was the photographers that are working at this time that exposed these images to the rest of America. It was a slice of contemporary America, clear, hideous, and beautifully detailed in images and words. I began to get the point. And by that, I think he means what Stryker was telling him about how to really tell this story. So these are two images that Parks did after getting to know Ella Watson a little bit better. And when you contrast this with the sort of propagandistic, sort of symbolic image in American Gothic, you can see him sort of cultivating his eye. He would go on to, you know, go in and photograph Harlem life. So this is a spread from life in 1948. And this one photo piece really emphasizes this one gang leader named Red Jackson. He would then go on to collaborate with Ralph Ellison, the writer of Invisible Man, and do a photo essay series that interpreted the scenes of the book. And, you know, this informed his second major cinematic film, which was Shaft in 1971. And though this film falls into the broad category of blaxploitation, you associate it with the high platform shoes and pimps and players and pushers, and all of that is true. If you peel away a lot of the marketing memory we have of this genre, it really just comes down to crime fiction on screen. And Shaft is actually a stunningly beautiful film, as this image shows you. And this is before Scorsese makes Taxi Driver. This is before Dog Day Afternoon. This is before Serpico, which are like three other films that are sort of really well known for them using the urban environment as the character. And Gordon Parks working in Shaft is one of the earliest cinematographers and directors to sort of tell this story. And the film is full of these just amazing shots that, as you know, if you recall the images I was showing you earlier, come directly out of his photojournalistic experience. I'm going to read this quote because this is where we begin to look at how I'm bending this back against looking at issues of Blackness, anti-Blackness, long-term effects of racism and slavery. And this is a quote from Hortense Spillers from Arthur Jaffa's film Dreams Are Colder Than Death, which visually is heavily influenced by he's heavily influenced by Gordon Parks. Black people 200 years ago didn't have a prayer, beat the skin off our bodies, kill and rape our mamas in front of us. We didn't have a prayer. Now we, the head of international courts, president of the United States, sitting on the United States Supreme Court, president of university, CEO of American Express, you name it, some black person is it. But the price of that is to lose this precious insight into something that connects you to something human. We're losing that connection because we're buying this other shit. I know that. I'm now going to shift to a philosopher by the name of Timothy Morton, who wrote a book called Dark Ecology, which takes a sort of long, high altitude view of climate change, global warming, and the sort of philosophical struggle that we're going to have to deal with to approach it. And the core concept in Dark Ecology is this notion of agrologistics, a specific logistics of agriculture that arose in the Fertile Crescent and that is still plowing ahead. Logistics because it is a technical plan and perfectly logical approach to build space. Logistics because it proceeds without stepping back and rethinking the logic. A viral logistics, eventually requiring steam engines and the industry to feed its proliferation. And when I read Dark Ecology, you know, as a part of the broader discourse on the Anthropocene, and a lot of people mark the colonization of the Western Hemisphere as the beginning of the Anthropocene, you can't not think about plantation slavery as one of the systems that fueled the growth of capitalism in this part of the world, and therefore fueled the situation that we're in today. And Morton sort of brings agrologistics as a longer term concept. He traces all the way back to the Mesopotamia, but that means we can also pick it up in the Delta of the South and in the plantations of the Caribbean and South America. And in this book, he talks about these four affects that we go through as we confront climate change, which he calls a hyper object, meaning that it's in its scale, in its physical scale and its temporal scale, you can't grasp it as a human being. You can only get these pieces of it. And these four affects are guilt, shame, melancholy, and finally horror. So here you've got the Ross ice shelf cracking. Here we have one of the 2020 fires in Southern California. And these are just like totally apocalyptic images. But it also counts in terms of what photographers like Parks were doing with visualizing poverty. And for me, this is where the crossfade happens, because when these FSA photographers were photographing the refugees of the Dust Bowls, and when Parks was documenting the slums, and in this case it's Rio de Janeiro, but in the slums of Chicago, Harlem, New York, we go through the same four stages of affect that Morton is talking about here. People feel guilty, then they feel ashamed, then they feel melancholy. And if they do get further enough into really confronting the issue, they deal with horror. So these are two other images that Parks generated, you know, in the 50s and 60s that for me overlap with this notion of how we cope with these massive hyper objects that are climate and racism. And this is a still from Shaft that connects for me all of these things together. Again, this one shot where Shaft is sort of moving through different parts of New York trying to crack the case. This is an image from a music video for Flying Lotuses, Until the Quiet Comes, that was shot and directed by Khalil Joseph, who is another young cinematographer and filmmaker who is heavily influenced by Arthur Jaffa, who in turn is influenced by Park. So here I want to point out like how far the New Deal's efforts to include the arts have stretched, and they've really redefined Black visual culture as an outset. And I'm going to conclude here with what Fred Moten says about the experience of the Middle Passage. The reason we think about the hold of the ship as almost iconic of brutality, not because it absolutely totally shut down our capacities, our emotional capacities, our erotic capacities, our imaginative capacities. The reason the ship was so bad was because all those capacities were still online. That's how you could feel it. If all it did was deaden us, then it wouldn't be so bad. We were alive in that shit, still thinking, still wanting, still desiring. That's right. Still singing, still laughing, still coming. And this is where the point of intersection is really crucial for me, because this experience that contemporary Black studies is looking at, about really looking at what it meant to be utterly dehumanized, but to survive that, that's intersecting with the way that Morton is thinking about the real scope and impact of climate change at the broadest level. But what he's missing, in my opinion, is the fact that there is a whole group of Americans that have already gone through this experience and have quite a bit of wisdom and have been working the problem for 400 plus years. So this isn't something that is necessarily has to be freshly minted philosophically. This is something where if we can begin to reconnect these discourses between each other, we can recognize there's lessons that have been learned by the people that have been at the bottom of the system. And by that, you know, I'm of course in my specific research talking about African Americans, but it also includes all number of marginalized people and especially indigenous folk. This is my last slide, which sort of illustrates like, you know, in a more graphical or programmer's logic, like kind of how complicated the situation that we're dealing with is, and how we have to think about it in multiple tracks, right? So at the top, we've got this line of agrologistics, which is like never stopped. Obviously these arrows are meant to represent time and they're not to scale. The notion of white supremacy and anti-Blackness, you know, has been around for quite a while, but not as long as agrologistics. The Anthropocene, people have argued, begins at around the time that, you know, Africans are being taken and put to work in, you know, in the New World. Climate change is relatively short the way we're thinking about it. And then you've got this, the passage that I'm looking at is moving from the Middle Passage to chattel slavery, to the Depression and urban poverty, the New Deal, and then this intervention that photography played, and especially its role in presenting the truth, right? The goal of the FSA was to sort of show Americans the America they hadn't seen yet. And what I really admire about that program was that the point was to get artists to create these images that would then be used in all sorts of different contexts. So this leads us to the question of, well, what does this look like with the Green New Deal, right? So if we're now dealing with climate change and now digital technology and things like truth being completely undermined by that technology, then the role that the arts plays is really a very rich area of questioning. And that's kind of where I'd like to start our sort of concluding discussion is like, really, what are the issues that are involved here? You know, when telling the truth about the situation was really what propelled the New Deal's sort of artistic impacts. And now we have this notion of like, everybody's got high definition cameras on their phones. Everybody, you know, ostensibly has their own platform. So how do we even begin to think about the role that art plays when the system is not quite as centralized as it used to be? Thank you.
Wow, that was amazing. I think we should open it up now to everyone and maybe try to address a David's challenging question. Does anyone want to jump in?
I have a question. To me, it seems like time is a really important thing to think about here, you know, in terms of infrastructure. You know, will the new infrastructure that's put in place think about time in a much longer continuum than the short one that we've kind of been working with for so long, and how capitalism drives that? But also because of the imperative of dealing with climate change in the meantime, in the present, you know, it's kind of interesting that one of the ways that we might think around it is by thinking longer term as much as, you know, short term. And I was wondering how, you know, you guys might, you know, feel about how do you think we can get people to stop thinking about, you know, quarterly profits and start thinking about, you know, decade long rejuvenation, et cetera.
I have a great answer to that. Oh, go ahead, David.
I mean, all right, Zoom delay, right? I mean, I was going to say that, like, this is kind of what art does best, right? Like, its ability to dilate time as necessary. And I'm kind of optimistic about this because we've never had more technology to put anything in front of people visually or audio wise. Like, there's no limits at this point, given special effects technology, 3D modeling, binaural sound. I mean, I'm old enough to still remember the propaganda promises of VR, but now those are starting to come true. Augmented reality, and I'm totally skeptical of all of that, but I also know that in the hands of someone like Parks or a collective also, because I think that's also the model that we're moving away from, the individual sort of single Renaissance man talent into collective work. And I think, you know, with an 18-year-old kid, I'm sort of recognizing how they work in the world. And they're very much about collectives and posses and these sort of flexible networks. And I think giving them the tools to tell these stories and visualize them, I think, and ask them that question, right? It's like, you know, half the time, I think they just need to have the question put in front of them of, you know, if you could stretch time, how would you do it? And what would that look like? So I think it's to recap, it's that idea that the artists are the ones to help us tackle that. And this new model that these 18, 19, 21 year olds are dealing with in terms of flexible networks, I think are the second ingredient or a second ingredient.
Yeah, that's such a great point. But, you know, as Parks reminds me that a lot of what they were doing was documenting the present, which for us is now the past, but there's a you know, you're making history is happening and it goes fleeting by. And a lot of the role of art is actually capturing the moment. And like the instructions that were given to Parks, you have to capture the person too. And I think those instructions are really important for all of us working on you know, thinking about big programs and big politics, that at the same time, it has to work at all scales again. And it has to, the art has to connect, but even the, to do the documentation, you had to connect with the person. And I think to visualize a future, to visualize a green future, also means connecting with the person, the community. How can you do that? And I think you're so right, David, is you can unleash the kids today. Sorry for you young people, everybody's a kid to me now. To do these visualizations. I mean, that's a kind of art, which they see, you know, is often sort of dismissed, oh, that's sci-fi or something, but it's actually a part of getting people to utopian thinking. If you don't have a bit of utopia in your mind, you're never going to go anywhere.
Go ahead, Marina.
No, I was just going to say, Billy has to hop off soon, so I want to hear from you, Billy.
Sure. Well, I think on that last thread from Dick there, I mean, I think that's such an important point because the right has been so good at imagining their own version of utopia and realizing it, and the left for a long time abandoned that kind of thinking, that kind of praxis, and to see it kind of reemerging, or perhaps just not being as submerged as it once was, I think is one of the things that gives me the most excitement, the most hope about some of this work. And I was thinking about this question from Stephen in relation to the one David kind of posed for us at the end here, which I think is one of the most important questions Green New Dealers will have to answer. And I actually wonder if thinking about the decentralization of art or cultural production is actually a problem. Maybe this is actually an advantage in some ways for us in thinking about just the scale, scope, and pace of what's coming, both of the climate crisis and what's already underway and will continue to be the mass like dislocation, relocation of hundreds of millions of people across the world, many of them in the global south, many of them moving to and within the global north. And what is, and even within the United States, the, you know, the most conservative estimates have somewhere between 10 and 15 million people's homes they live in today being, you know, completely submerged and uninhabitable by the end of the century, and tens of millions of more that will, you know, be adjacent to water and likely in real estate markets that have crashed and cratered and probably forced them to leave as well. And so the scale, scope, and pace of that kind of loss isn't unprecedented, but for most of us in our, like, you know, for those of us on this Zoom who are alive today, it's pretty close to unprecedented. And I think about that in relation to also the scale, scope, and pace of what a program like the Green New Deal demands of us, which is probably to, you know, I really, Dick, I want to see like these numbers somewhere at the Living New Deal site for the number of projects, because the 100,000 number is new to me. So at some point, really, like, I want you to send me that link. Because that's actually just like way more exciting. But I think the Green New Deal right demands that we probably build the most stuff we've ever built as fast and as well as we've ever built it in ways that hopefully restructure rather than reproduce the way the Global North relates to the Global South. And I'm thinking especially of, you know, clean energy technology here and the supply matrix of earth minerals that goes into producing them. Like, how are we going to do that in ways that actually allow us to live up to our small D democratic principles, community self-determination, some of the things that the New Deal actually emphasized in ways that turned out to be quite catastrophic. It allowed things like, you know, sewer socialism to prosper in Minneapolis and the Jim Crow-like coalition in the South to lengthen and strengthen their rule, mostly because it was agnostic about power. And so, these things keep rattling around in my head and thinking about the decentralization of art and cultural production as maybe a way for us to think through a different kind of new federal art or federal works project that is less about identifying, the singular creative geniuses and more about, I think, leaning into this idea that many of us are actually producing some of these cultural artifacts.
It probably needs a blockchain. I mean, I think the Green New Deal like needs a blockchain, that the art should take advantage of this NFT thing, which again, I'm skeptical of because it's basically a three card Molly game, but at the same time, you know, money is what you believe, right? So, and that's what the kids are looking at too, right? Like the idea that, you know, there's the work of like, you know, paving the road or pulling the wire or, you know, laying the brick. But I think, you know, there's got to be a major shift into like how and why we compensate cultural production. that's not extractive the way the social industries do it now, but is about investing in the people that are doing it. Because obviously the social media industries are extracting this cultural value from young people all the time, right? And converting that attention into, you know, into money, which is basically an extension of chattel slavery, right? This idea of, you know, divorcing you from yourself and extracting this labor, right? And this is the way I backed into, you know, this research in the first place. But I don't want to dominate that moment, but I think there are some things on the table that are sort of in this gray zone between kind of neoliberal capitalist experimentation, but also what hip hop has sort of done best, which is like take the bits and pieces of what works and do unexpected things with it. And I think we need to kind of take that seriously as an American tradition as we go forward.
I don't know if I mean, I can think about arts at a certain scale, like, but I'm not sure if I know, like, I'm just gonna say, in landscape architecture, in urban planning, I can see things at a big scale. I don't know what that would look like in the arts, except for maybe on a programmatic level, like, you know, at the scale of like public schools or, you know, community art centers or something like that. But I have to say, I don't have an imagination for what that means to scale up the arts. Do others?
Well, if you mean, when I was talking about scale, I was talking about program mm-hmm. levels, mm-hmm. Not the art itself. Though I'm sure the artists will come up with God knows what. I mean, obviously, movies, for example, film, commercial film operates at a very different scale than a painting. And so that's not unprecedented, and people can imagine different scales of design and so on. I don't think we have to worry about too much about that. I think I generally worry about the programs. But I do think David's point about liberating young artists from the grip of commerce. I mean, you're doing two things with any kind of federal program. One is the relief side, which is a lot of artists who can't make money, who can't live as artists. And if you have a program, you liberate them to actually just, you know, do their work. But beyond that, you're also going to free up a lot of kids from this, you know, pursuit of money on Instagram or working for big studios or whatever else it might be. You will, and you get them to see another way that it's possible to exist as an artist. And you know, the New Deal had that effect, I think, widely with all its government programs, that people, you know, business was delegitimated profoundly by the Great Depression. And then government was legitimated by what it could do and for people, but not just, again, giving them money, but energizing them and giving them things to do, whether it's photography like Gordon Parks or it's some bricklayer working for the WPA, making a beautiful wall. Those things liberated people from the grip of business. Everything is business, everything is money. There was an earlier comment about, you know, how do we get CEOs not to think of the bottom line? You're not gonna. So that's why I have to make more of the economy governmental and social, either through government or through cooperative kind of endeavors. But if you don't kind of break the grip, the vice-like grip, especially of the tech world, the digital arts, break the grip of those bastards. You can read my book about them. Those bastards, to give people another way of thinking about how they can do their work and go about their creativity.
And I think we can bake in the connectivity that if you are a recipient of Green New Deal arts funding, you can bake into the network who else is doing it at the same time. And I think that'll create some unpredictable, I think, positive feedback, right? That if you're stripping pipes in Iowa and I'm making a music video in South Central, and yet the network connects us and I know right away that you're doing this too, I think that's the upside of the always connectivity system that we've got built. So instead of, we can move the history that Dick has sort of documented more closer to the present, so we can know right away what's going on as a participant, instead of having to look back on it later and then be like, oh my God, like, this is what we did, you know, like 30 years ago. I think this is one of those rare moments where the technology and the opportunity could really be transformative, you know, in the same way that radio was, you know, 50 to 60 years ago. I think we have a narrow window to sort of capture some of these technologies that are going on, the energy of the young people, the power of the representational power of the technology. I think we're in a really sweet spot right now. And people want to tell their stories, you know, but right now they're being dominated by the follower mentality, right? Which is like, if I get enough attention, then the sponsor will give me money, you know, because I've got enough views on the video. And I think we could break the bastard's grip with a little bit of government intervention, you know what I mean? To break the influencers away from just doing something dumb or risky to get the views and actually do something a little bit more constructive. And I know for a fact, because I'm living with one of these kids, that there is a generation of young people that are absolutely committed to doing better with this technology.
I want to, thanks, David. I want to jump in and pose a different question that's for all of you, but maybe I'll pose it to you first, David, building upon your presentation about Gordon Parks. You know, your presentation focused very much so on the psychological violence that communities of color in particular face, not just in recent years, but for centuries. In your last slide, you invoked the power of photography as a documentary tool that has the capacity at its best to reveal these fundamental truths and in so doing to challenge them. There is another body of work that Gordon Parks produced that I'm sure you're familiar with, in not during the New Deal, but in the years that followed when Ellison invited him to Harlem to photograph the Lafargue Clinic. And you know, it is not that the clinic is this kind of romantic space of healing, but nevertheless, it is a clinic in which despair is trying to be transformed into determination, as one caption read. And so I guess I was wondering if you could talk about the therapeutic power of the arts, the possibility that the arts help us heal, and in particular heal in the face of a psychological violence that's in unending and ceaseless in its force, in so many ways that you outlined. And yeah, so I was wondering if like a Green New Deal on some level would be also one that would have to psychologically transform us and help us heal in the face of the ravages of these past decades.
I think the answer I'm about to give is not prescriptive, but I think Shaft is really illustrative that he made this film that I was talking to my mom about it like last night when I was preparing for this, and my mom is 80, 81. And she said like, wow, I've never seen the film the way you're showing it to me. Because when we saw it, we were just psyched to see this Black dude, like, not getting his ass kicked, you know, moving through the city naturally with empowerment and all the problematics of, like, you know, he's the guy that gets all the chicks, blah, blah, blah. But like, there's a generation of folks that saw that film as highly empowering. And the fact that it was also beautiful is I think really addresses what you're talking about, Aaron. The idea that like, art can absolutely be therapeutic, even if in retrospect, like, well, there's some problems with that art. And I think this speaks also to what Dick was saying earlier about there's some of this work that we saw that got made during the New Deal. If we look at it now, it might be considered racist or white or too masculinist. And that's true. But I think that's why I had the illustration of multiple tracks, right? Like, we have to be able to look at things in simultaneity. So I do believe that that the art, I don't think you can prescribe it to be therapeutic. You have to trust the artist to know their community. And I think that's the other thing that the government is going to have an issue with, right? Is like, you know, because there's still forces of it. I mean, we're still dealing with the culture wars, right? We still don't trust artists in this country. Like, we still think it's a waste of money to support the NEA, right? Because you're just going to, some guy's going to do Piss Christ again, and what are we going to do, right? It's like, there's still this like ongoing fear about what art does, which unfortunately commerce and Hollywood has taken over, right? So I think to get back to the space where there it's even aimed towards a sense of telling the truth through your art, whether that's theater or dance or a temporary space. I think if you know that you're being funded about this Green New Deal, about restoration, about conservation of people, and we trust the artist to do that, then I think it could work. You know what I mean? I think you're gonna get the therapeutic work out of it, along with just the fun, cool stuff that we'll look back on as propaganda. You know what I mean? Oh, you're muted, Sarah.
Yeah, I just was mumbling. I have a question. I'm just so blown away by these presentations. Thank you so much. And I have to say, it leaves me feeling less sanguine today, at least. Like, because it, especially when I was, and I do have a question, but especially just kind of looking at these different visual notes, especially that Dick and David left with us. And I just saw a presentation by a farm researcher last night who talked about how, even though there's funding available for it, most farmers, big farmers, well, first of all, of course, that land is owned mostly by brokers now, like most of the big farms. And there's incredibly, the farming practices are really incredibly disastrous. They continue to be, even, you know, organic farming, organic big scale farming. But anyway, but what she said just in passing was, even after all this time, after the Depression, after the Dust Bowl, there's only 4% people who are doing no-till who could. So like, and so David's presentation also just made me feel like, and especially because of what Stephen said, there's this, not only is it about the future time, like, you know, how to stretch out time and how to be able to create a long-term vision that will sustain a political cycles, but also how to compress and refract and crystallize the time of the past in order to have it be brought to the present, not to be quoting, but, you know, to make it understood, because people don't understand the relationship of the plantation is seen to the Anthropocene, for example. Like, it's very rare that people will make that association. So my question is about, so I guess it's to Dick or to anyone who has some, you know, also David, you might be able to answer, to Billy or anyone, who, the people who administrated, you know, a few years ago, I tried to get a USDA grant to make a community kitchen. It was a very, very realistic, needed project, and, you know, 2 years in a row we applied and didn't win it. So who, yeah, it was an art project and a social project. So who were the administrators of the New Deal? Like, how was it possible to have so much visionary, so much license? Like, you know, there's a lot talking about license, like letting people go and do stuff, but who do we need? Like, are those people around? Is there any way that it's going to even be possible to bring those people into the positions where they're going to be the ones who are going to be able to say, yeah, go for it?
Well,
what kind of people were
there? There are a lot of those kind of people around, but I think, you know, when you actually go back and look at the New Deal in detail, there are certain people stand out and certain people who are just extraordinarily good at seizing the moment and going for it, and not, you know, and Harry Hopkins is always the one that comes to mind. He's the WPA guy, and he just said, I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna give relief. I'm gonna give jobs to people. I'm gonna get, you know, somebody asked him about artists, and he says, well, they have to eat too. So and he didn't worry too much about the subtleties. And you need those kind of people at top. They may not be the great thinkers and policymakers, but you need somebody who kind of like hammers, and that's what he was. He hammered himself to death by the end of the war because he just worked himself like to a frazzle. But yeah, extraordinary people step forward if you make openings. I think that's the lesson. If you're bold enough to kind of not just say, oh, well, we can do a little of this and a little of that, which is what the Green New Deal is offering. you know, you take bold measures will attract bold people who, and bold people are often quite willing to let others have their head. Now, I think, you know, FDR set the tone because he let people, you know, he hired an array of very different people, some of them very conservative, horrible people in State Department and War Department, and who stood in the way, you know, old Southerners and so on. And then brilliant progressive people out of New York, like Harry Hopkins and Francis Perkins, and let them do their thing. And didn't interfere too much with them. I mean, they didn't give them what they wanted a lot. Anyway, that's a long, long answer to a short question.
No, it's a great answer.
I think that was an amazing question to end on, our conversation to end on. This has been extremely rich. I think we've kept you half an hour over the time we said, because we've enjoyed it so much. Thank you all for being here. Thank you, Dick. Thank you, Billy. Thank you, David, for your incredible presentations. And I think this is a lot of rich material in, with which we'll go into the next workshops. And we're going to invite all of you back if you'd like to sit in on them and add to them. So maybe this group will grow over time. So thank you. Have a lovely afternoon, a lovely evening. Some of you will be going to bed. Thanks so much.
Thanks, y'all.
Thanks, Maria.
Bye, everyone. Thank you again.